Thanks for joining the podcast again. You live, like, did you grow up in Denver? Are you originally from here?
Nah, I grew up Houston, Texas.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, okay. And then I bounced all around. I mean, it's been 19 years since I left Houston, so.
Okay. Why did you move here from Texas?
Before here, I was out in California in Big Bear doing the whole ski bum thing. I came to Colorado because I saw it as the place that had, like, I mean, this was like 14 years ago. All the music I liked was, like, kind of happened to be getting made in Denver. You know, that was back with Pretty Lights, Michael Mennert, Big G back in the day, Numa Trio. And that was, like, when this whole scene was, like, just starting to be a thing. And, yeah, the one thing I noticed in common is everybody was here. So yeah. I figured that if I came out here and made an impact, that it would actually matter rather than being like the coolest kid in Houston making electro soul beats.
Yeah. Well, now you're the coolest kid in Colorado making like funky hip hop electronic stuff.
Maybe we'll throw it as Lakewood.
Lakewood. Oh, I'm also in Lakewood, actually. I just got a condo there.
Yeah. I'm like Wads and Colfax.
I'm pretty close. I'm Wads and 285.
Gotcha.
That's like south, I think. I'm directionally challenged when it comes to the city.
Yeah, I'm directionally. That's the bane of my existence.
Yeah, same. Thank God for Google Maps. Remember MapQuest where we had to like print all of our directions out, and if you missed your turn, you had to like read it upside down.
Oh yeah, yeah. Having a booklet to go across the country.
I'm really thankful for technology. You just released your album "Pocket Full of Dreams." Congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah, I contributed to your Spotify streams for the last couple of days. It was good stuff, man. I really like it. And like I said, I told you earlier, I've been following you for probably since like 2015-ish. I saw you with the Floozies in Indianapolis where I used to be back in the day. And yeah, man, really love your stuff. Like you're heavily sample based. Definitely like the Pretty Light sampling vibe. Like you mentioned, I can pick up some of that influence for sure. Mm-hmm. You're about to be on tour, or you have played a couple shows, have you?
I just started my tour last weekend.
Yeah, with Floozies. Park Breezy's going to be on that tour too. He's dope.
Yeah, well, so the Floozies were just kind of like the couple random shows I didn't have that weren't like quote unquote part of my tour. Mm. But this past weekend was a little bit different. We did, I had Mikey Thunder and then Kevin Donahue from Sun Squabby played the Casual Commander sets. But the majority of the tour is me, Park Breezy, and Motif. And then a couple dates are Polidor instead of Park Breezy.
Cool. That's a good lineup, man.
I'm stoked. It's the first time I've been able to like go across the country and actually curate a full lineup myself. As far as a tour and my whole like idea for it is just to bring basically like a night of Cervantes around the country, like try to just give a little slice of Denver.
And you're playing your first Mission show debut. That's yep. exciting too.
Yep, yep.
It's my favorite venue probably in Denver, next to Red Rocks.
I mean, it's like one of the best venues in the country. Yeah. Like from how thoughtful they were and everything from like the bars to the bathrooms to like backstage to you know, I haven't been on the stage yet myself, but it's awesome.
It's really cool. And I might be wrong, but I've heard this from several people that the stage actually retracts based off of how many people are there.
Yeah, it's a scalable room. I think it goes from like 2,500 to 4,000, something like that.
That's probably right. So like, I'd love for people to get to know you a little bit better who maybe don't know about you, and then maybe we can get kind of nerdy. This is the Ableton podcast, obviously.
Yeah.
Maybe share your music background. Like, how did you eventually get into Ableton Live?
Going all the way background, I used to just kind of mess around. I grew up dicking around on the guitar, kind of. I took piano lessons, like I think a lot of people do, whenever I was a little kid for like a month. Yeah, I mean, it was later, and I mean, it probably wasn't until I was like 22 or so. I was out in California and had some buddies making beats. I just thought it would be a fun thing to do. You know, I started messing around, and I got pretty lucky that very early on into making music, I was still on FL and stuff back then. I had a buddy who was working for The Mountain, did videos and stuff for Big Bear, and I was just sitting there making beats, and he was like, hey, do you want to make beats for The Mountain and for our videos and stuff? And I was basically doing the snow bum thing, just working in the cafeteria to get a free season pass. And they gave me a free season pass just to start making music for them. And then the next year, we kind of worked it up a little bit. And then at a certain point, I Yeah, it was actually one of my good friends in Denver. He had dabbled in Ableton, and you know, I started out with a Phantom, just making like, you know, 8-track beats on that, and then went to FL. Thought I had to get on the pro industry standard and started learning Pro Tools and everything, which was like at the beginning. And like, I don't know, I still don't think Pro Tools is a very creative program. It's awesome for what it does. Yeah, once I got on Ableton, I was like, all right, it felt more like an instrument to me than like a program. I mean, it's been my baby ever since.
Yeah, I agree, man. Like, I started in Pro Tools back in the day, obviously after GarageBand, but I really felt like it was so amazing for mixing and tracking. Anything else I wanted to do, mm-hmm. It was like a pain in the ass. That's kind of how it felt back then. I'm sure it's like updated now. Honestly, I haven't used the latest version of Pro Tools, but
I think it took me like 3 days to figure out how to record, just how to arm record in Pro Tools.
Yeah.
I was just like,
Yeah, that's how I was in Ableton. It took me a whole day to figure out how to get sound out of it. Yeah, I'm glad those days are over.
Yep.
What year was that you started using Live, or eventually how did you get there?
I mean, that was probably like 15 years ago, so.
Been a while.
Yeah. What was that? Probably like 2008, if my math is right.
Nice.
But yeah, and I mean, I'm not, like, you know, we were just talking about, like, you know, about Evan. Like, I am not a Ableton guru or anything, but I am able to, like, quickly and efficiently have it do what I want it to do.
Yeah.
Which I think is, like, the cool thing about that is you can be as surface level as you want with it, or you can, I mean, make all your own Macs for Live devices and, yeah, like, really, you know, really get into it. But yeah, I still think, I mean, it's my baby.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. It feels like the most quote unquote open sourced DAW out there, just because of Macs for Live and like they're constantly updating it.
Right.
Some people argue that they update it too often. Honestly, I've even heard people say that, because it's like, oh, we had 10 Suite for I don't know how many years, and then 11 came out, and then, like, you know, they're always adding new versions so quickly. And which also I think is cool. It speaks to like the team, like, wanting to innovate.
I had a mini heart attack. Like, I don't know, I kind of lost it when Poldor on our last track we made on the track we made for the album, he had updated and I had not. And I got the project file over, and then just, it was just my stubbornness and that, yeah, just getting used to the new like controls of the interface of where the warping was and everything. And it definitely took me a second to come across, to get out of my stubborn old ways.
Yeah. It's like the Great Wall of Live. It's like somebody's like on an older version. And you're like, oh, I'm about to stem this thing out. Yeah. So much extra work. I forget what it was. I was in Laura Escudé's class for MasterTrack, which like highly recommend anybody wants to get into like playback. Like, she's the queen of playback and her team. And they're actually doing MasterTrack again in person. I just saw an email. But anyway, she had some kind of cheat code for going backwards. Like, you could go from 11 to 10 with some kind of like script thing.
Okay.
And I never figured it out, but I kind of want to go back and like and do some more research on how she did that. And now that I think about it, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll update everybody if I can figure that out.
I know some people who would be very grateful for that.
Yeah. I don't think it's an easy process, but it is possible, apparently.
Right.
So I don't know. If anybody knows out there, please let us know, because that would be sick. So I don't have to do the research. Yeah. So, like, let's talk about your sampling process. You do a lot of sample based stuff. I mean, you have an entire series of volumes of albums called Vinyl Restoration. I'm assuming that's all vinyl that you sampled. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that makes sense. What does your process look like for that? Or maybe even like going back a little more, like, what got you into vinyl sampling and how does that process look like?
Some of the stuff at the beginning was out of necessity. Starting out as a producer, you don't necessarily have access to amazing music, you know, musicians and guitar players and full horn sections and, you know, proper studio settings to record, you know, said instruments and stuff. And at first it might have started a little bit more, yeah, a little bit out of necessity. Also just, I mean, the majority of my favorite music is sampled, you know, is sample produced music. And there's a nostalgic factor there that's, to me, like, there's a really nice sweet spot of like mid 70s where the technology is the best, like, for that era where the technology kind of started to really catch up. Just the vibe and the sound set is something I really fell in love with. I'm an absolute sucker for Rhodes. I love horns. I love the imperfection of the singers back then. You know, now, like, singers have And I'm not knocking on it, but like, you know, now a lot of, you know, singers have vocal coaches and they take care of their voices and live a lot healthier lives. Like there's something about a cigarette smoking, whiskey drinking, just pure raw emotion, you know, like, I mean, Etta James, I mean, with the way that music is now, the chances of us getting like another Esther Phillips, you know, like of such a unique voice that isn't necessarily like, quote, I don't know. It's just so unique. It has its own characters and its own thing that like, I feel like there's a lot of that missing in music today that with over-processing and a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It's hard to find a truly unique voice these days, I feel like. Maybe I'm oversimplifying, but
I know what you mean. Like, I think it goes to the recording quality too, of like the imperfections. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, Aretha Franklin didn't use autotune.
No.
So like, it's like that rawness. There was like no pitch correction really happening. They had to nail it. So
imperfections are what give music human, you know, humanity and life.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, even not even just vocals, even just drums, like the first thing, you know, that I feel when everybody starts out, they're on the grid. Mm-hmm. And like the biggest thing I can tell anybody is get your snares off the grid.
Yeah. Seems like it takes a little extra
I mean, and even something as simple as just, you know, nudging something a little bit can just give it such more swing, human out, you know, such a more human feel and to get it off the robotic, which is just like, it gets old.
Well, I can't say too much, but Ableton's really working on that and it's coming soon.
Okay.
So that's really super exciting. Actually, it's going to save a lot of time for that kind of thing.
Nice.
Yeah. Obviously those imperfections, like you can feel that soulfulness and it's almost like you're time traveling when you're taking an older piece of music and you're just like chopping it into something new. It feels like you're time traveling and you're also like recreating at the same time. It's kind of cool.
Yeah. You know, there's something to be said about just keeping that music alive. I'll be riding in an Uber or something, and, you know, they're like, oh, what are you in town for, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I tell them I make music. They're like, what kind of music do you make? And I'm like, I trick kids into listening to soul records. Mm. Like, you know, that's basically I get 20. And, like, if I can go and play a show, sample some stuff, some people, you know, work down the line, and then a year or two later, they're just listening to Stax.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I know, like, personally, like, I didn't have parents who played soul or funk music or anything. And I got into that, like, that path by, you know, listening to RJD2 and stuff and then backtracking and going down that rabbit hole. And it's cool to be able to be a part of keeping that alive.
Nice. Yeah, well, it shows, man. You've been making a lot of music over the years. I'd love to learn more about some of your sampling process too. So like, do you have like a record player? Do you like run that straight in like an RC input or something into?
Yeah, I just run record player into my, I just have a little 450 that, just cause when I'm by myself, it was a lot easier to travel with than trying to lug around a 900 or anything. And I just run my record player into the mixer, that into the patch bay, into just an Ableton. And,
cool.
I switch it up. Sometimes I'm like actively digging, going through, finding something that hits me on the spot and then just kind of getting after it right away. Sometimes I go through and, you know, when I go to the record store, I'm picking up like 30 to 50 records at a time. And so sometimes I'll just take a day and just get everything in and kind of catalog it and actually go through and like put in, you know, blah, 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 in parentheses, like dope keys, organ, horns, you know, and kind of label it as like what I would be using the source material for. And that kind of helps me sometimes whenever I'm really going through and like kind of collaging stuff. And I'm like, I just really need a horn line. And then I can go through and, I mean, it's kind of a cheat code, but later in my days, like more recently, I've been cataloging a lot of stuff in mixed in key.
Yeah, dude, mixed in key's dope.
So then I have just a huge library of stuff that's all, you know, and then I can go look by tempo, by key, you know, whatever. And then I still have everything labeled in there. Yeah. So it's basically creating like my own, basically a mini splice full of just samples.
That's smart. That's a really good way to do it for sure. And you just create like playlists of each one or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you used the Mixing Key Studio Edition plugin?
I have not.
love that thing because it's a VST. So it runs inside of, you can put it on a specific tracker on your master. So if I open up a new project and I don't want to like mess around the keyboard and figure out what key it is,
yep.
I'll just throw it on the master and then hit play and it tells you the root key and it shows you all the harmonic notes,
gotcha.
Which is kind of cool.
Kind of scary at the same time too, because I'm not trying to dog on anybody, but like, I think music should be accessible for anybody to make. Anybody who wants to make music should be, you know, yeah, get after it. But like some of the newer producers with like kind of no musical background that I hear kind of doing some sampled stuff. And I'm just like, do you not notice that this is out of key? Like for me personally, when something's out of key, it feels like nails on a chalkboard. My stomach is like turning, know, like it's just everything. I'm like, this is wrong.
Yeah. Your brain short circuits.
Yeah. Like, and to hear some stuff where, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not a gatekeeper of music, but at least figure out how to get stuff in key.
Well, maybe you should. Maybe you should be the gatekeeper. Yeah. We need somebody to help those people. Be like, yeah, listen, just like 30 minutes, Andrew Wong's, music theory course. It's free on YouTube. That'll help. At least something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it is cool at the same time that I think technology puts more music into the hands of creators. Like, it's kind of, I don't know, I'm torn between that because my music theory sucks. But I have a good enough ear just because, like, my whole family has been into music. I genetically think I have a better ear of knowing what's in key or not. Some people don't have that. Might have to do a little more work. But it's cool that technology lets more people create, even if they don't have developed skills to do more. But
yeah, I mean, it's more accessible. I don't think everybody needs to necessarily monetize their hobbies, you know? It's a little bit detrimental when, like, I see a lot, I don't know, when people go and they see a shit, like, their motives for making music.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, again, not trying to be too gatekeepy with it, but, like,
yeah.
I don't necessarily think that going to a show, seeing somebody on stage and being like, I want to be that guy is necessarily the best motive to get into this. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with that. I think like your intentions are really important behind music. It's like, are you wanting to create because it's what your soul wants you to do?
Right.
Or is it because you just want to be some famous dude behind a DJ controller? And, you know, that is important because there's a lot of that too.
If you dig any bit below surface level, I think it's pretty easy to tell who's where people's motives lie.
Yeah. Yeah, I think eventually that comes out. You know, that's, I'm trying to have more of that intention too of like, why am I making music? Is it because like I feel like I have to, or is it because I want to? You know, I think those are two motivations. And like, I'm trying to do more of the want these days because I want to do it for me rather than just because it feels like a chore. You know what I mean? Especially when you monetize it, like you were saying. That could be a really tough balance for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. It's hard to get in you get in a circle to where, you're sitting down and when you're creating for a specific purpose. I'm at my first creative, completely like clean slate where I don't really have any projects I'm working on right now. I don't have any albums I'm writing towards. So like, it's very, it feels awesome to finally to be back at a spot to where I can just make whatever I want to without having to be like, oh, I need to make this for this show. I need to work on this for this. You know, this album is still missing these songs. Like, and to be able to create freely without any expectations is pretty cool because that's when you get to be able to take chances. I always think that you perfectly okay to make 15 songs that are whatever to get to that one that's awesome. You know what I mean? And like, you have to be able to have the freedom to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. That's good. That's good insight, too. So you talked about, like, okay, you'll, like, go through, back to your sampling thing. You'll take, like, your vinyl. You'll, like, organize the vinyl by, like, okay, this has really dope horns. This has really whatever. And then maybe you categorize that into mixed in key. And then as far as, like, recording that into Ableton Live, do you just record, like, long 16, 32 bar loops and then chop it up, maybe put it in like simpler sampler? Like what's some different workflows or hacks maybe you use?
I typically record full songs in, you know, I have, then I, you know, then I bring them into Ableton. I kind of bounce around. I have everything from, you know, just getting something, even just not warped at all and just doing a random, you know, chop to quarter notes, whatever, and just see what happens. Even when the, like, it's not warped, it's just going to give me a bunch of random chops. And like, I'll do everything from that to actually quantizing and then, you know, having very set chops to like getting in there just in a arrangement view and chopping, you know, chopping the hell out of just audio.
But
it's just kind of, yeah, like what I'm feeling. More for like hip hop beats and more kind of simple stuff is more like hand chops, you know, on some of my more intricate, like more what I would call like full compositions or kind of full like storytelling songs. I might get in there and get a lot more surgical with the chops.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of like convert audio or slice to new MIDI as an effect and stuff like that?
Yeah, that'll a lot like whenever I'm just kind of trying to figure some stuff out, that might be like my first kind of quick thing to do, because you know what I mean, it takes 15 seconds and then all of a sudden you have chops.
Totally.
And just getting there and feeling something out. And then if I a lot of times even from there I'll get a bass chop out, go into piano roll, and then, you know, maybe I'll get my A section as a nice little easy, you know, pretty simple chop, and then for my B section I'll get into piano roll and just start moving stuff around. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, it's literally like if you're sitting over my shoulder listening, it can be extremely frustrating. So I'm just like literally in my head, I know what note I'm looking for. Yeah. You know, I'm waiting to find, you know, this whatever, maybe it'll resolve the phrase, what, you know, whatever I'm looking for. But in my head, I already know the note I'm looking for, and I will go through just literally just hitting up, you know, put it on preview to where, you know, anytime you move it in the piano roll, you're hearing it. And I'm just pressing up, 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 up until I get my note. And I'm like, all right, cool. Next note. Buh, 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 buh. And
okay.
So it can be pretty aggravating for my girlfriend. But yeah.
Well, shout out to her. She must be very patient. Yeah.
She used to be. Now I pretty much work around her. Yeah. She's a nurse, and I try to be, we live in a smallish house, so I try to be mindful, and I try to get most of my work done while she's not in the home.
That's nice of you. It's very considerate. Have you seen those like meme videos on like Instagram or whatever? It's like what people think producing's like, and then it's like what it actually is like, and it's like some dude just like playing with a kick drum, like scrolling for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's what I feel like green rooms always are, and everybody thinks it's like this big. And like, don't get me wrong, sometimes it is a big crazy party, but the majority of the time it's a bunch of sleepy dudes on a couch just wishing they were in a hotel room.
Yeah, that's honestly facts. I heard Mr. Bill in one of his podcasts say that like he now puts Legos on his rider. It's like,
it's a good move.
Yeah, it's really smart actually. I was like, maybe I should do that in the future. It's actually smart. Yeah, sampling, chopping it up. Slice Doom MIDI is really dope. Like if anybody didn't know, a lot of times what I'll do is like I'll go in and I'll just create warp markers on like the best hits in here, and I'll find like, oh, these notes, I want to capture these. If you're looking at the video on this podcast, and you right click and choose like slice new MIDI, and this is after you warped it, and then you can go into the option of warp marker, so you can create slice per warp marker, and then it'll just spit out only those warp marker sections, right. Or you could do transients or notes or whatever, and that'll plop it into a drum rack for you. So if anybody's not doing that, it's a good sampling tip.
Biggest thing, and I feel like this took me a couple years to figure out, and this is one of the first things I always tell people if they're sampling, save yourself hours of heartache. Play your sample before you record it in, tap tempo to what the sample actually is playing at, then record it in that tempo, and then your warping will just pretty much be on, you know, just on point, as opposed to like,
totally.
I don't know. I know some people who are like starting out and saying, you know, they're still warping everything in at 120 and like having and I'm like, you're going to kill yourself with that. Yeah.
That's a thing. I used to do that too before I found the light. Yeah. And actually in Ableton Live 11, they updated their warping algorithms. So it's like way smarter now. If you take, and then you might've noticed that, but like, if you just take a song that's not recorded to a beat or a metronome and you throw it in there and you just get a relative tempo, it'll actually just lock it in for you really well now.
Nice.
It's surprisingly well. I was shocked when I tried that in the new, I think it was 11.2 when they did that or something.
Yeah. I've recently been trying to not warp as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Which gets a little, it can get a little tricky.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to that whole like human swing error kind of thing.
Yeah.
Where it's like more humanized. Also, this is completely random, but I saw your post about doing a VR set on your upcoming tour. That seems really interesting. Maybe explain what that is.
Final Restoration.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I was like, damn, that's really ambitious of him to be playing a set and be playing another set that's VR, like virtual reality before that. That's crazy.
So I'm opening up on this tour. I'm opening up every night with just my like 80, you know, low 80s BPMs, just like kind of boom bat beats, which is fun for me because it's this year was the 10 year anniversary of Vinyl Restoration.
Oh, congrats, man.
And it was just it's stuff that I don't really get to play out very often, and I don't know, midnight at a club on a Saturday night is not exactly the time for 82 BPM gospel beats.
I'm always here for that,
but getting to open up the night and also like kind of controlling the vibe of the night for the tour, and being able to like, I mean, this isn't a shot at anybody, but you know, like it can be a little frustrating when, you know, like our music is a little bit more niche, and to have an opener at 8:30 playing, you know, crazy mainstream dubstep and drum and bass and stuff is can be a little bit jarring. And like, it's like, dude, you're playing harder stuff that I'm going to be playing headlining tonight. So yeah. Yeah. It's fun to be able to control the vibe a little bit more.
That's really smart, actually, to like warm people up. It's like the pregame before the set. That's really smart. So how long is your entire set then if you're going to be doing that before your actual set?
I'm doing 45 and then about 80 minutes after. So I'm playing a little over 2 hours every night.
That's a good set.
Of all original music. So.
Wow. That's a lot of prep.
Yeah.
This episode is sponsored by Lewitt. They sent me their Pure Tube microphone, and I am absolutely in love with this microphone. I'm using it right now with minimal processing for the sponsorship segment, and it's in an untreated room. So this is just the raw sound with a little bit of compression. And I had a great conversation about tube mics and the Pure Tube with the COO from Lewitt.
Glad you like it.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining the podcast. Why did Lewitt feel motivated to create this Pure Tube mic? Like why another tube mic?
Maybe first I want to explain that, you know, at Lewitt we are a bit of a different company, I would say, than most microphone manufacturers. And when you look at the whole industry, it's a lot inspiration from the vintage mics, from the heritage. There are a lot of, you know, clones of these legendary microphones, but we are kind of the polar opposite of this spectrum. We develop all the microphones with new circuits, new designs. So we have the freedom to kind of choose whatever we want to do. The idea behind PureTube was to build a microphone that all the money you spend, you get just, you know, the best possible sound out of it without any of the bells and whistles that you might get from an even more expensive mic like the 1040. The 1040 is, internally we say, like it's the Swiss Army knife of microphones. You can adapt to any sound source. You can use it in almost any situation. PureTube, we focused on, you know, vocal and speech applications. And as you mentioned, of course, you can use it in others as well. So it's an analog microphone. It has a tube inside, but it has also a very modern circuit in that it actually removes a lot of the components. So there's no semiconductors or capacitors in the signal path. But around, we have very modern circuitry to allow us to kind of keep all the benefits of the tube, you know, warm sound and all the things you associate with it, but bring the noise down that it can compete with, you know, modern microphones, and that it can also be used in modern production techniques.
The frequency response on it is pretty flat compared to a lot of other mics out there, especially tube mics. And I've noticed you can compress the crap out of this thing and it still sounds good, which is kind of fun, you know, for all different kinds of applications. And like you said, the noise floor is extremely low. That was probably the first thing I noticed, is just cranking up the gain on this thing. The noise floor is, I think it's around 7 dB. Is that right?
Yeah, it's 7 dBA, which I would assume is the lowest self-noise in any tube microphone. And even compared to FET microphones, that is very, very low. And that's also the main advantage it has over more classic or traditional tube microphones. The idea really was, if you want your centerpiece vocal mic and you finally make that investment of around $1,000, and we are also very confident in the quality of the product, so we can offer the 10-year warranty. There is also a certain misconception around tube mics that, you know, if you ask a few people, some of the voices will be, well, they are more fragile, they are more prone to breaking, you cannot move them, you need to replace the tube. And it's actually not true, at least not for modern tube mics like the Lewitt PureTube.
Yeah, I mean, that says a lot. I feel like I could drop this thing off of a bridge and it probably wouldn't break. It's got some good weight to it. And just even like the presentation of the case, opening it up, it felt like I was opening a small spaceship. It was just like this really, really cool packaging. And you guys obviously put a lot of thought into this product, and I think it really shows and it sounds fantastic. Yeah, I think this is going to be my new vocal mic I'll be using in the studio outside of just the podcast for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where it will shine. Yeah. You find all sorts of information, technical spec on our website, of course, and as well as where you can purchase it. So depending on the country, our website will display the best dealers to purchase from.
Yeah, dude, thanks again for hanging out on the podcast and sharing this microphone with me. Like I said, I really love it. It's not just because I got it for free. I'm a big fan. Yeah, happy to talk about this mic and share it with other people. I think it's important for anybody who's serious about making music, especially a vocalist or instrumentalist, to invest in a good microphone. Obviously, you can get a good sound out of, you know, a $200 mic. You can make it sound great if you want to. But there is something to say about investing in a really high quality mic. Just to take your skills and quality even just a little further, there is a noticeable difference in the end.
At some point, if it's your profession or your serious hobby, you kind of gravitate towards one thing that, you know, one really high-end piece of microphone. It's really for those people that I think should look at it. It's not something we would recommend for, yeah, your first mic.
So for your live set, you use Ableton Live, right?
Yes.
Okay, I thought so, because you don't use CDJs. Did you ever use CDJs?
Nah.
No,
I play stemmed out sets. So I play, to me, one of the coolest things about playing your own original music is having the ability to, you know, do fully stemmed out sets where, like, I think if you ask most DJs, if they were like, hey, do you want this studio recording of this, you know, this full song, or do you want to have the ability to manipulate vocals, bass, drums, you know, body? I think most people would pick the latter.
Yeah.
So to me, like, playing original music and then just playing it off CDJs is, I just feel like you're missing out on a lot of creative mixing you could do, you know, about from taking just little stems from one song to the next. And I don't do it as much anymore, but when I used to play with a lot of live instrumentation, it was really easy. And for me to have, you know, my guitar part recorded in a stem. And then whenever I have, say, you know, my buddy Drew Birch from Recess sitting in with me, all I have to do is mute that stem and then he can rip the guitar live. So it's opens up a lot of doors like that.
100%.
The way I put it is that when you're mixing live on CDJs, you are doing more in the moment. You know what I mean? But I do a lot more homework on my sets. And it's not like, and I am still quote unquote reading the room, just because after all this time on the road, I know that if I'm going to play a set with the Floozies, that this is probably what this crowd's going to like. If I'm playing my headline set and I know I have like my dedicated fans there, I know I can get away with maybe playing a little bit more down tempo or something. Mm. Or if I'm playing a big bass music festival that, like, you know, so like I am like quote unquote reading the room, just doing it ahead of time.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I just already know the crowds. I'm not playing a random club. You know, I'm not like, who's in here tonight? Like, I know what fans are going to be at the shows I'm playing.
Yeah. That helps.
And yeah, I mean, it is more preparation. I've always had a thing with playing original music that I've stepped up my transitions a lot in the last couple of years. But starting out, like, I still have no shame just Fade to Gray or sending to a delay and washing out a song for my transition, because I fucking made, can I cuss on that?
Yeah, whatever. You got it.
I fucking made it, man. I can do whatever I want with my song.
Right.
If you're playing somebody else's music on some CDJs, yeah, you better have a dope transition, because that's what you're doing. That's what you're showcasing, is your song selection and your transitions. Whenever I'm playing a show, I'm showcasing my music.
Yeah.
So, like, I've always been pretty stubborn with, like, yeah, it's my song. I can do whatever the hell I want with it.
That's true. It's your set.
Yeah.
I mean, it is your set. So, yeah, no, I think that's a good mentality to have for sure. So as far as like what types of stems do you consistently stem out? You mentioned guitar.
So like my set right now is I have four main channel stems. I have kind of like a main body kind of thing. Vocals, bass, and drums. I mean, really, it also gets down to me just getting bored and me being able to, like, just put a filter on the vocals or just put a beat repeat on the, you know, on the sample or the drums or whatever. It gives me more to be able to do without, like, constantly sweeping the whole song and whatnot. But yeah, so I have those four stems. I have one extra channel that is my quote unquote, my chops that I keep muted. So I play out chops live. And then if there was a problem with my controller or something, you know, all I have to do is press, turn the channel back on and I have that stuff playing again.
Oh, smart.
And then I do like, three transition tracks. So, you know, whether it's me bringing in the drums from the next song on the last 16 bars of the one I'm playing or whatever. And that's what makes it really cool with the stems is you can like, get really creative with your mixing and just bringing in, you know, baby little elements of a song before, song after, and really, really do some cool little like mashups and yeah.
Yeah. So are you using the crossfader like A and B between the two different groups or like?
No, I am doing more kind of filter and volume, transition stuff with that. Pretty much only really use my crossfader for like dropouts and stuff like that.
Okay. Nice. What controller do you use?
I just switched over this last weekend to the Launch Control.
Yeah.
I was on the APC, which I loved the MK2.
I do too.
I do not know why they made this new APC 64 with like 8 touch faders. And like, to me, it just seems like a...
I haven't even seen that.
Yeah, they discontinued the MK2. I've had one. I mean, we have a Guitar Center rep that we have had one on back order for like 6 months. I was playing on a broken APC for like literally like, yeah, almost 6 months on tour trying to get a new one. It was impossible to find. And then they just announced the APC 64.
Oh, the 64.
Oh, it's the one on the left that looks like the launch, that looks like the... It looks like the push.
It looks like an upside down push.
Yeah, it's a less integrated push, which I don't understand who's in the market for this.
Weird.
But I feel
it has no actual physical faders.
Yeah, no physical faders, no knobs.
That's why people really went
to APC. Yeah, like, and this is the only piece of gear I've ever commented on online, and I was like, yo, honest question, is anybody like happy about this? Like,
what?
I feel like it just alienated all of the actual professionals who use the APC.
Yeah, dude.
Like, I don't know.
That's weird. I mean, so the faders are all digital now. I don't know if I'd like that. That would make me nervous.
Oh, yeah. I don't trust that at all for performing live. And it just doesn't... I don't know, man. There's a feel with...
yeah, you got to like just grab it and chop it up and down.
I'm not trying to look down and be like, nah, okay, dude. Like, you know, yeah, I'm trying to rip a fader and then keep it moving.
You know, the evolution diagram of man from monkey just getting bigger. Yeah. I feel like this is the opposite. If you go back to the original APC 40, that thing was a tank, dude. You could throw that off a bridge and it would be just fine. And then the second APC 40 got like more breakable. Like that was cheaper plastic. The crossfader on the MK2 was way more delicate.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing to go.
At least with the recessed faders on that, I personally went through like probably 8 of the old school ABCs.
Really?
And I know homies who would break them, who would go through them like all the time.
But you could fix those. You could open it up. The new ones, it's actually the way it's soldered in or the actual, what am I trying to say? It's way harder to fix a fader on the MK2 than it is on the originals.
Gotcha.
So from that standpoint, that's kind of a bump. But yeah, this is really interesting. I didn't know this was out.
But yeah, this thing bums me out.
Yeah,
I don't understand who this is marketed towards. And
well, Akai was sponsoring this episode. No, I'm just kidding.
Thanks, guys. But sometimes, yeah, I don't know. I wish that like it makes me wonder how much actual like artist input they have.
Yeah,
into some of the stuff, you know, because like.
I would be curious to see what those pads feel like.
Well, I don't know if they realize too that the majority, I don't know anybody who really uses an APC in their studio. You know, like an AP to me, an APC like is a live performance controller.
Yeah, most people use it for that for sure, or even VJing. A lot of VJs.
I mean, it's an industry standard. That's what I loved about it too, is that no matter where I was, I knew I could, like, even if mine broke, whatever, I knew I could find an APC.
Yeah, 100%.
And now it's like, I don't know,
that's
kind of disappointing.
You know, I wonder, yeah, that's a good point. Maybe they are trying to appeal more to the studio audience. Maybe that's what this is kind of going for, which is interesting. And one complaint was, like, you couldn't really necessarily use the pads to trigger, say, like a drum rack on the MKs, unless you downloaded a script.
Yeah.
You'd have to have a script for it, which you could do.
Which I never really saw. I don't know. That's what the push was for. That's right. What, you know, yeah. That's what other...
I'm wondering if that's maybe their attempt to also try to get into that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, all the videos I've seen of them promoting the thing, it's all like actual like in studio like performances and stuff. Like actually making music as opposed to performing it.
I mean, for $400, you could get, for maybe like an extra $50 to $100, you could get a push too.
Yeah.
Interesting. No, I'm glad you told me that. I didn't actually realize that was a thing. Weird. What inspired your new Pocket Full of Dreams album? I'm curious. Like, it definitely has like the late night radio vibe to it. Yeah. It's a little more mellow.
Yeah, it was kind of coincided a little bit with, you know, when you're on tour on the road all the time, it's very hard to not make music without the intent of playing it live.
Yeah.
You're making a really cool chill song. You're like, all right, well, that's dope. But like, I'm not going to put this in my set. This isn't going to like, you know, I don't know. So it kind of feels like you're not maybe using your time the best. And during lockdown, which is where I started a lot of this, it was nice just to get back to making music that, I mean, for me, it was kind of like getting back to my bread and butter and like what I think I do best is like taking vinyl records, taking stuff and telling my own story out of it, you know? And I think there's an inherent art and skill to being able to take something that's already created and, flipping it, manipulating it in a way to tell a completely different story.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just kind of me getting back to my quote unquote roots and really having a good time on making music that I thought told a story, really made me feel something rather than just trying to make me dance.
No, I feel like you definitely have a good diverse album library. You've got like some heavier, more live stuff, and you've got a lot more chill stuff, which is probably also great for streaming. You know, a lot of people love that. I mean, lo-fi, I think, is like just a great moneymaker for a lot of people who just crank out tons of lo-fi, or has been, I guess, over the last decade.
Yeah, everybody can do their own thing, you know, but I don't understand if music is kind of like getting out. For me, it's a way of getting out how I feel and my emotions and, you know, and if I don't feel the same all the time, how am I always going to make the same music? You know, yeah. So like to kind of lump in to be like, I make 128, blah, 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 blah. You know, like that just seems so creatively limiting and just so like on an expression level, just so limiting. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I take a lot of pride and have fun in being able to go all over the place. And I think that also makes a much makes a better, more well-rounded, like kind of live show experience. My funny one that I equate to is like even the gnarliest like action movies are like, you know, I see all these things as the same. I see an album should have the same trajectory as like a movie. A show should have a live performance should have the same trajectory. You know, they're all kind of pieces of art, of work that can start somewhere and end somewhere else. And like, it's like the equivalent of having a John Wick movie where like he comes in, he kills 13 dudes. Then he goes in the next room and he kills 26 dudes. Then he goes in the next room and he kills 48 dudes. And it's like, where's the context? You know, and like so many live sets and so much even music these days, people say that nobody listens to albums anymore. And I think that's because a lot of people don't make albums anymore. I don't think an album isn't your 10 best songs. It's your 10 songs that go together to tell a story that you want to tell. And that's not necessarily going to be the 10 bangers, you know, like that have no context to each other and don't build anything. So for there to be highs, there needs to be lows. For something to be loud, something else needs to be quiet. And that dynamic is really powerful. And if you can make, it's harder to give somebody the chills than it is to make them dance and sweat. But if you can do both in an hour playing live, then you got them, you know. And I feel like a lot of people are also, I think that comes with maturity in performing and that being willing to like play some down tempo music and have, you know, 1,000 people basically standing there staring at you. And it's not that they're not having a good time. It can be that they're captivated. It can be that they have the chills and they're reliving some moment in their life. And they're like, and that to me is a lot more powerful than just putting your hands up in the air and dancing.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's context. If you can nail both of those, then you just gave somebody like a whole emotional roller coaster. They come out of that hour and they're like, that was an experience.
Totally. And I think that's, you hit the nail on the head, is the experience part, because that's what people want. People want to have an experience. Huh. And if you, and that's that art of contrast, I think, where it's like the big banger moment and then also the moment where you just get into the feels and, you know, like having that contrast of going back and forth and having that dynamic wave that you're writing for a show or just even an album, like, is what really makes people come back for more, for sure.
And then get back into even what we were saying about kind of mixing and letting stuff play out, is that there are certain artists that some of my favorite parts of their songs are the intros and outros, because that's where they get a little bit more.
Totally.
We get a little bit more musical with it, you know, like that's where you're setting everything up for when that drop comes for it to matter. And whenever you're just mixing drop to drop to drop to drop, it just misses that context for me. And then it gets a little bit just too, here's this, you know, it's just like, oh, this is even bigger than the big. It's like, well, it's not big anymore, because everything I've heard in the last hour was big.
Right. My ears are bleeding at this point. Yeah. That's really good, man. That's good insight for a lot of people to think about, for sure, out there. I actually had that similar conversation with Rob, Homemade Spaceship. You might know him. But we were talking about this same thing, and he was like, he has this track called Voyager on his newest album, and it's like 10 minutes long. And he's like, I almost didn't put it on there, because like, I wasn't sure if it fit the album. It was just kind of this random in the middle track. And it's like literally like five songs into one song, but it's like really low and then gets really high energy and then gets really chill. And that's like my favorite track on the album, but he almost didn't put it in there because it wasn't like a traditional type of song structure, which, and now it's like his most popular song on that album.
Yeah.
So,
and that's something, if you told a manager or like a major label, you know, A&R or executive or something, they would be like, nobody wants to listen to a dynamic 10-minute song. And it's like, dude, you don't like,
you don't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll find out. Yeah. No, that's true, man. That's true, too. I think it speaks to the heart of, like, music and why people make music. It's just, like, do it for yourself and do what you feel, you know?
I think a lot of people also on that end forget that their teams work for them.
Mm.
Artists get big or, like, have their break by doing what they care about, and then they make it to a certain point, and then they give away that creative control, almost like whether it's to their fans, who it's like, well, they react better to this, so I'm just going to make more of this. Or they, like, you know, or this is what the algorithm says is working, or they look at Spotify and just see, well, this song took off and this one didn't, so I just need to make more of these songs. And I just think people need to remember that, like, your fans and we're drawn to you because of what you believed in, and just to, like, stay true to that.
Dude, that's good stuff, man. You should write a book about that. The late night radio memoir.
I might need to be a little bit more successful before anybody actually takes what I have to say with
my grain of salt. Might be surprised, dude. I love a good book, man, especially audiobooks. I would buy it. Yeah, man. So back to Ableton Live stuff. Is there any, like, specific device or audio effect or instrument that's just like your go-to bread and butter that you just couldn't live without? And how do you use it?
That's an interesting one. I'm not a numbers guy. You know, like, I have certain friends who they listen to something like, oh, you need to pull down that 2K, hit up in this and that. Like, I'm a overall feel kind of person.
Mm.
I mean, you kind of have me stumped on this one. I mean, I know, like, I go through phases. Like, on my last album, kind of my babies on that were like, my Rhodes is kind of like my secret weapon on just kind of adding little baby layers that, like, honestly, they're a lot more noticeable when they're gone than when they're there, but they just add an extra organic element that, like, fills that mid-range space that really gives a lot more organic feel, like, you know, taking kind of like a more stagnant, you know, VST and layering that with, like, live Rhodes just really bring that to life.
Dude, I love
I was messing around a lot with using my OG 404 more as, like, an effects rack.
Okay.
And running, like, my Rhodes or my Juno or, like, the Polylog or whatever, like, straight through the 404. And it just kind of gave it a whole another little flavor.
It's cool.
You know, again, getting back to the human touch on it is, you know, instead of having such timed out perfect delays, you know, of having just some more kind of loose, you know, 404, it's not like
changing it from sync to time. It's not locked in. Yeah. That's nice.
The majority of my productions is honestly, is my samples.
Yeah.
and really getting that palette. And, you know, every song has anywhere from 2 to 8 different records on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Juno and Rhodes. That's like, I hear a lot of that in your music. That's a good staple too. It's just kind of like one of those timeless instruments that just, I feel like really you could apply it to anything. It just sounds good every time.
Yeah. Those are my babies. The Juno, the Rhodes, and the 404 are like my three pieces of gear that like I'll never get rid of that are just kind of my old timeless, like I am very proud to have them in the studio.
Proud instrument dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feel that. Have you ever played with the electric instrument in Ableton Live? It kind of is modeling some of that Rhodesy stuff. Like I like the MK1 Mellow preset. Some of these presets are actually, they've got kind of like a warmer vibe and you can obviously clean them up a little bit. But some of them sound a little cheesy, but you can really kind of clean it up.
Yeah, my trick for all electric pianos and stuff on MIDI is at full velocity, they always sound a little bit cheesy and real belly. And, you know, I always throw velocity at like max, like 70, you know, 65 or something.
Softer.
Yeah, and it just gives that a lot more kind of soulful.
You maybe could distort it a little more too if it's softer to start with, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, without being too harsh.
Right.
Nice. Yeah, that's a good tip. Yeah, I love the Arturia stuff. I'm like addicted to a lot of the Arturia, like soft synths that they have.
Right.
They make a lot of really solid synths and keys. Like their Whirly is pretty cool. Their Prophet, man, I love this thing. The Prophet's super dope. The Mini V3 too. And this is obviously outside of Ableton, but they're always running deals. They're always running deals for their V-Lab.
Yeah, that might be the next...
This thing.
My next splurge might be a Prophet.
Like an actual Prophet?
Yeah.
How much do those normally run? A couple grand?
I think they're up in like the 3 to 5 range.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Definitely like 3.5, 4. Those things are solid. I don't know.
Yeah. There's something about just getting my hands on a piece of gear, one knob, one function. Is my like just feels I don't really like menu diving and stuff anymore, and like I anything that I can just like instantly touch and it just feels like I can just, you know, get creative from it off the bat without having to, you know, dig around for 8 minutes is what I'm like drawn to.
Something about just like physically handling gear, it just, especially that analog sound, you can obviously try to get it really, really close digitally, but it's just not really the same.
Yeah, it's never fully there. The little intangible things that make analog. It's just very hard to recreate.
That's why I've been using more tape machines for that reason, to take like digital stuff and get it dirtier.
Yeah. And it's getting back to exactly what we were saying at the beginning. It's that like imperfections, you know.
Yeah.
Like it's that's what makes stuff actually feel real.
Yeah. So maybe talk about your record label. How long have you been with Philos?
A little over 5 years now, I think.
I said that right, didn't I?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought I did.
Yeah.
I'm like, I was second guessing myself. So I think that's right.
Honestly, it's... I am eternally grateful for Philos. And, you know, I was on... we did Super Best Records for a little while with... with Michael Minert. Back in the day.
Yeah.
And the only problem with that is it was 98% creativity and 2% execution, you know?
Yeah.
And, we were just a bunch of artists and like, we had really cool ideas and we just didn't really know how to implement any of them. And we didn't really have any financial backing or anything like that. so when that kind of, fizzled out, you know, and I was kind of, you know, I've always had a great friend group in music and like really close connections with my peers and stuff, but to actually like have a home and to have like a team, you know, I'm very thankful for it, man. This industry can be really hard, and to not feel alone, and especially like with something like Philos, to where not only do I think that like it's where, you know, the roster is full of, you know, straight assassin producers, it's also like my best friends, and they're really good people. And everywhere from Jordan, our owner, who like I have nothing but amazing things to say about. Like I don't know how a label could be run anymore, you know, with artists in mind first and still being, on the business side, being executed very well. I don't know how I could have a better situation. And, even where we're at now, one of our things is like, even if it works out musically, like if somebody was to come onto the roster, like whatever, is it going to change the hang? Like if we're all in a room and then you add this other person, is that going to completely change the dynamic of this? Cause if so, like, that's not exactly what we're looking for, but like we're between, you know, it's Daily Bread, Artifacts, Durly, Recess, you know, K-Lab, just put out some stuff with Philos. We have a couple other, you know, I should probably be hush hush about, but a couple other people coming over for some releases that like, it's absolutely perfect. It's it's a really cool home for us. I mean, we're organically growing every day. The community, the fan base and community around it is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm very thankful to be a part of it.
That's awesome. Yeah, it definitely feels like a family vibe. This is like a killer lineup too. I didn't know Kill Paris was... is this updated? I don't think it is. This is on stereofox.com, so that might be outdated. I was like, I didn't know some of these guys were still on here.
No, that's not. I mean, and there's been some art. There's been some people throughout the days. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, Parker just dropped on... you know, Michael's... had a couple of releases.
Yeah, it's a stacked lineup. I love all these artists.
Yeah, you know, Ageless and Sway were the OG like backbone in it. It's a really cool thing to be a part of.
I feel like that's how a label should be. Somehow over time, like labels have gotten like a really bad rap. You know, just the word label, and it's like, no, there's still really good labels out there that like want to do good by their artists and really help them grow. Like,
yeah, it's either very mainstream and like very just, you know, bottom line oriented, and very business oriented, or there have been a lot of really cool art like labels that start out as artist run labels, but then as the labels grow, you know, and the artists are dealing with their own career, that they have so much going on that they aren't able to put in the same attention that they were that made the label what it was. And they start passing off the label, you know, the label responsibilities to their managers, and their managers pass it off to their assistants. And then all of a sudden, like the whole genuine decision-making, I don't know. I feel like anything is only as genuine as every decision put into it. And the more genuine and the more authentic you are with like every decision you make, adds up to something, to a final product that is like, can be very either commercial or very genuine and heartfelt.
Yeah.
Once those labels kind of get passed along to a manager's assistant and they're, you know, it just kind of loses the whole heart that went into making it what it was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well said. So last two questions real quick, and I know that you probably have to go, but yeah, dude, it's been cool hanging out with you again for the first and a half time, I guess. Yeah. We met briefly at the Matty O'Neill party.
Okay.
But yeah, what advice would you give to yourself like 10 years ago when you were producing? It could be anything. It doesn't have to be just Ableton producing stuff.
Enjoy the ride. I feel like, you know, and that is their job, but with, you know, with management and agents and stuff, like, you sell out the 500 person room, and instead of like really celebrating that little milestone in your career, you're like, all right, well now we're going to go do the 1,000. And you never really take the time to like sit back and like realize that you know, you're sitting there busting your ass and you might already be living the dream that you were chasing and you don't even realize it yet. You know, it took me like, in my career, it's taken me having kind of breaks and stuff that I thought were kind of more of a negative thing. And then sitting back and realizing that, like, I don't know, man, you know, I've been living off my music. I haven't had a job in over a decade. Like, I live completely off my music. And that's like, no matter what scale that is, like, that's ridiculous.
That's like, not super common.
You know, like, yeah, you know, I get paid to go play songs that I care about with people that I care about. And, you know, it's something that maybe, you know, other people are working and looking forward to for 6 weeks, and every day at work, they're like, it's okay, I get to have this one night of release. And like, for me, that's my job. Like, that's ridiculous.
It's pretty dope. Yeah, that's sick.
And yeah, just to kind of, you know, take a second to take the wins in, enjoy the little things. You're always going to wish you were at some, you're always going to wish your name was a little bit bigger on the festival flyer. You're always going to wish, you know, there were a couple more people at the show. There, you know, I don't know. There's all these little things, but in the grand scheme of it's, I'm not huge on the word like blessed, just because I feel like you should also take credit for, you know, the hard work you've put in. But I am extremely lucky and fortunate to, like, I've had the opportunities I've had to be able to do this. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you clearly have worked hard, man. You've been grinding and releasing a lot of stuff over the years, and it shows. It shows for sure. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to more. Any upcoming projects you want people to know about?
I mean, honestly, like I said, right now, I'm completely clean slate. I have some ideas and some stuff I want to do. Like, I really want to do a full length album with just me and MCs.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Which, holler.
Holler at your boy.
Honestly, I usually just put out an album and then, like, move on. I spend all this time putting out a record. I am self-admittedly horrible with promotion. I feel weird promoting myself. It makes me feel like, I don't know, doing this like, hey, look at me, you know, like, yeah. that doesn't come naturally to me.
Me too. I feel the same.
And for the first time, I'm trying to actually, like, let this project, you know, this pocket full of dreams, let this project breathe and give it the attention it deserves. Yeah. That's why I'm happy to, you know, I'm touring on it, on the actual Pocket Full of Dreams tour until the end of February, and to, like, be able to throw this album in people's faces for another 4 months and, like, instead of just moving right on, I'm excited about, like, trying to, yeah, give this product the attention I believe it deserves.
Yeah. Maybe you'll do a VR live show sometime I got confused and got my hopes up. No, it's cool, man. It's good stuff in the pipeline. Thanks again for hanging out. Really appreciate it. Your time. I know you're hella busy and you got a lot going on, so.
All good. Yeah. Sorry. I don't know. Like I said, I'm, as far as, like, the nerding out thing, I am much more just like a feels guy with Ableton. Like, you know, just like,
That's cool too.
Make it yours, man. You know, do, like, if you want to sit there and make, you know, Max for Life devices and stuff, like, and code all day, get after it. If you just want to, like, just throw some stuff together that feels good to you, then, you know, all the more power to you.
I think that's just as important as the technical stuff. Understanding if it sounds good, it sounds good. Don't overthink it. You don't have to be, like, the most technical, nerdy person in the world to make great music.
Right.
You know? So, like, I'm here for all of it.
I have friends that, I mean, I'm not going to drop names, but I have friends who, yeah, spend hours on a snare, you know, EQing and compressing and everything.
Sounds terrible, actually.
I have buddies who, like, are very successful, who their warping isn't even that great. They just use the Ableton stock limiter and throw that thing on at, you know, 15 dB from the, like, the start of their project, and they are playing Red Rocks, you know, like, it's, there's no right or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's good to know some of the rules to break all of them. That's how I feel.
Yep.
Absolutely. Well, let's end on that. I feel like it's a good note.
Word.
All right. Bye, everybody. Go stream Late Night Radio. It's sick. You'll like it.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, dude. Of course. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. Do me a huge favor if you would and hit that follow or subscribe button wherever you're listening to the podcast. If you don't hate the podcast, please leave a 5-star review. It would help me out a ton. Don't forget to check back on Tuesdays for new episodes. I plan on cranking out a lot more in the upcoming future. Also, if you didn't know, on Spotify, if you click on an episode on mobile, you can interact there and you can tell me what you think about this episode and other episodes, and it would be great to hear from you and see what you're thinking about the podcast. If you want to be the first to get new episodes and stay updated and get free new devices and sample packs and other stuff that I'll be sending out in the future, join the newsletter. Just go to liveproducersonline.com/newsletter and or check out the links in the show notes. Make sure to give this guest a follow on the socials. Give him some love for spending their time. And once again, thanks for listening to the podcast. I will see you next time. Later.